It's that time, and we're picking back up with our study of the Old Testament, introduction to the Old Testament, and looking at different parts of the Old Testament. I realize it's been some time since we've seen one another. How's everybody doing? Everybody's good? Good. We are, again, going through our introduction of the Old Testament, and as always, I would encourage you at this moment to open up your Bible to the book of, actually, the table of contents. We're going to look at the table of contents for just a moment. Again, we'll be trying to cover a lot of material, a lot of time, and so we'll have to do this quickly. We've missed some classes together. We were supposed to have 20, and that's getting narrowed down to like 12 or something like that. So the Old Testament's big, and we've got to cover a lot of material. So in your table of contents, you've had what we talked about, the different sections of the Old Testament, how you break it down, and it's easier for us to walk through the story of the Old Testament. By the end of this class, ideally, we'd like to be able to, the ideal scenario is that all of us could sit down with somebody and take the table of contents and tell them the story of the Bible. And that's the idea of behind this class as an introduction. We don't have time to get into the nitty-gritty of the stories, the details, but to give a general overview of the Old Testament, we're using the table of contents. And so initially, if we talk about the first five books that you see in your table of contents or on your phone, what are these first five books typically called? But the Pentateuch, the law of Moses, and what are we dealing with in these first five books? What's the Cliff Notes version of these first five storyline-wise? Do y'all remember?
Creation.
The wandering. So we go, who's writing these books?
Moses
is writing these books, right? And we know Moses gets called by God at the burning bush, and that's when he starts writing it. But why does he write Genesis? Why does he write a book that goes back to the beginning of all things? Why does he start there? It's the law. God told him to, right? That's the short answer. But why would God need to give people an origin story?
Well, they need to know where to start.
Yes, sir. He's calling them out of Egypt, out of slavery, and giving them their origin story, right? And here's where God has worked with you. Here's how God has prepared for this moment and your people. And God has made promises to your family and calling them out. So you have Genesis, and then you have Exodus. What happens in Exodus? We exit, right? I like that. It's nice. We leave Egypt. We wander. We have the giving of the law in Exodus. We have the Ten Commandments and those kind of things. Then you have Genesis, Exodus, and
Leviticus.
That juicy book with all kinds of fun. Yeah, so a lot of just law there. So we have the story of the origin of mankind narrowed down to one family in Genesis chapter 12 with Abraham. And then we have the story with them being in captivity in Egypt, and how they got there, and then leaving, and then wandering, and then complaining, and whining, and dying, and finally going into the promised land. Deuteronomy, we don't actually quite get there. When we end the book of Deuteronomy, where are we as a people, the Jewish people? Where are they? They're right on the other side. They're on the cusp of going in, right? On the cusp of going in, and Moses is telling them in the book of Deuteronomy, do not forget God, right? I mean, if he could have grabbed every one of those people by their tunics and shook them and said, don't forget God, that's what he's trying to do with the book of Deuteronomy. And so he doesn't go in. And then we start the next section of Scripture in our table of contents. So we have five books of law and history, but the books of law, books of Moses. Then we go into 12 books of what? Perhaps your favorite subject in school, right?
History,
right? 12 books of history. And we start with the conquest with Joshua, and we go through the Judges, and we've talked about Judges and Ruth, and we're going to be looking at the rest of these books. We're going to try and cover a lot of books in the next few moments together. as we look. We're trying to go through 1 Samuel through Esther. Do you think we can do it? And y'all looking at me like, I don't know if we can do it. We'll see if you can do it, right? That's maybe a more appropriate question. So we're going to try to get through this and look at just a brief synopsis. What are we dealing with in these books? So as we look at 1 Samuel, and I messed up on my timing on that one. Let's just put it all up there. 1 and 2 Samuel. Initially, 1 and 2 Samuel was written as one book, one scroll. But it was rather large. And what do we do with things that are large sometimes? Break them up, right? And so that's what happened. So 1 and 2 Samuel was initially one scroll. It was broken up when they began to do the codex and made it into one. And we see here also that we see the fulfillment of God's promise as far as delivering kings, providing kings. Look over in Deuteronomy chapter 17. Would it surprise you that God talked about kings before they even happened? No. Deuteronomy chapter 17. Verses 14 through 17. When you enter the land which the Lord your God gives you, and you possess it and live in it, and you say, I will set a king over me like the nations who are around me. Wait a second. This is God saying, and they almost verbatim said this phrase later on, we want a king like the nations around us. And so you shall surely set a king over you whom the Lord your God chooses, one from among your countrymen. And so he begins to talk about what's going to happen with a king, and who was supposed to be their king? God was their king, and actually in 1 Samuel chapter 10, he says, Samuel's freaking out that they want a king. So remember, Samuel's a prophet, and deals with about the life of prophet, the first seven chapters, essentially, and Samuel's freaking out that they want a king, and God is saying, they haven't rejected you, Samuel, prophet of mine. They've rejected me as king over them. And so those are things that, as far as the contents of the 1 Samuel, we look at the life of Samuel and King Saul. So we see that transition from this prophet and judge kind of construct that we've seen in the book of Judges, and we transition into a time of kings. And Saul was the first king. And we deal with that in 1 Samuel, deals with the life of Saul, also with some overlap with David. 2 Samuel deals with the reign of King David, and so we'll see that as we go through. I did not set that up right. Okay, next time I'll do better. I promise. So some important passages in this in 1 and 2 Samuel we see here. The Lord God of Israel, I brought you up, Israel up out of Egypt and delivered you from the hand of the Egyptians and from the power of all the kingdoms, but you have today rejected your God who delivers you from your calamities and your distresses, yet you have said, no, but set a king over us. It's one thing for them to have wanted a king to rule as a king in just day-to-day necessities, but for them to have gone so far as to reject a God is really the point that needs to be made here. They want a new system. It's not that they want just to have a king. They want to have a king like the nations around about us. And that's the thing that they're rejecting. Yes, sir?
Aren't we like that today?
Oh, you mean we're guilty of dispossessing God from his place in our hearts and putting something else in? By no means. Yes, we are guilty of doing that. And we can be guilty of overstepping those kind of bounds as well. So we are human. We make similar mistakes. Another important passage in 1 Samuel. Samuel said, has the Lord as much delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to heed than the fat of rams. Do you remember the context of what happened here? This is open book. You can... What was the context? What was taking place? Saul was doing a good job.
When Saul didn't obey God's voice and kept back some of the spoils.
Yes, sir. Exactly. So, yes, sir. So he thought he was going to you know, they were supposed to kill everything, right, when they went into the city and just utterly destroyed it. And Saul thought he was going to keep some. And it's like, but it's for the it's for God. It's for sacrifices, right? We weren't going to keep it for ourselves, promise. And what, and here's what Samuel said, you've done wrong. You've done wrong. To obey is better than sacrifice. And so an important passage, important concept in this book. Did I go too fast there? Okay. Also in 1 Samuel 17:45, then David said to the Philistine, you come to me with a sword, a spear, and a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have taunted. So here's David steps onto the scene. Does David step onto the scene in a small, insignificant way as far as the storyline of Kings? He's anointed, and then we kind of forget about him for a little bit, and then David steps onto the scene, and where do we, what is probably the one of the most famous things about David? What's the context of this?
Slewing Goliath.
All right, yes. He killed Goliath, and this is that context. They face off in the valley. He says this, and a tumbleweed goes rolling across, you know, that standard, that scene between David and Goliath. And so he steps onto the scene in a big way. But what do we learn? What is David saying about himself here in this verse that we see play out over and over and over again in David's life?
The part where he says, "You are a circumcised dog."
Yep, he was quite forward with him.
You are against my God.
Yep. What is it that we learn about David?
He trusts God.
He trusts God implicitly. He trusts God in every situation. He trusts God. He becomes this sort of warrior poet writing the Psalms and being a warrior of God. But when you read the Psalms, you see God is his sword. God is his arrow, his buckler, his rock, his salvation. And while he is a mighty man of valor, he still understands that all that comes from God. Did he mess up? Yes. He should have gone to war when he should have gone to war. He should not have stayed at home, right? So that's a lesson that we can learn. When you should be doing something, it's going to keep you out of trouble. And so in this situation, we learn a lot about David here in 1 Samuel 17. In 2 Samuel, we see, when your days are complete and you lie down with your fathers, I will raise up your descendant after you, who will come forth from you, and I will establish his kingdom. He shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. Again, what are we dealing with context-wise? What are we talking about here? Yes, so this is sort of this dual prophecy kind of thing in that God is talking to David here, but he's talking about a future events also, right? So we're talking about, this is a very important passage in talking about prophecies about Christ and about Messiahship. What, just pop quiz, from what lineage did Jesus come? From the, yes. So here is, we have, this continued prophecy. As you take passages that you just connect throughout the Old Testament to see the coming of the Christ, this is one of those key passages in seeing the coming of the Christ. So 2 Samuel 12:7, Nathan said to David, thou art the man, right? And sometimes we need to have that said to us. David messed up, and he took somebody's sheep that he didn't need to take. This is the parable that Nathan said to David. How did David respond here to this? He could have had Nathan killed. How did he respond in this situation?
He repented.
He responded the way he needed to respond. He got called out, and sometimes we need to ourselves be called out or call out others. First and Second Kings, we've got to rock along here. First and Second Kings, purpose. In these two books, we see the cost of sin in God's people. First Kings tells of the reign of Solomon and the kings of Judah and Israel, and we see that that begins to kind of fall apart. So First and Second Samuel was initially one book. First and Second Kings, initially one book. Samuel writing the 1 and 2 Samuel, and Jeremiah, most likely writing 1 and 2 Kings. And we look at these two books, and we look at this storyline, and we see something that kind of helps with these as well is that we have our first three major kings. We have Saul, who reigned for 40 years. We have David, who reigned for 40 years. And Solomon reigns for 40 years. And we thank them for being all the same year, so it's easier to memorize, right? And then things start to fall apart, right? Things start to fall apart after that. Rehoboam, Jeroboam kind of splitting the nation into two. And then eventually the northern 10 tribes being taken into captivity first, and then later with Judah taken into captivity. So time-wise, we cover a lot of time period in between 1 and 2 Samuel all the way up to 1 and 2 Kings with captivity and going into captivity. And it was because the people left God that they end up going into captivity. But a few key verses as we look through these passages here. As David's time to die drew near, he charged Solomon, saying, "I am going the way of all the earth," which is to say what? I'm going to die. Well, this is a fancy way of saying it. And so here's what he says to his son as he's going the way of all the earth. What is he encouraging him to do as he passes this mantle, the torch, over to Solomon? What is he encouraging him to do? To remain faithful. What was it when we see a king, when we look through 1 and 2 Kings and we see a king and the king dies, there's a comment that's made and compares them to whom after every king? Do you remember that he either walked or did not walk in the ways of his father David? And David becomes this sort of, it wasn't Saul, but it was David that becomes this example of how a king should act. And so here is this king passing on the information, make sure you don't lose sight. Don't lose sight of God. And of course, Did Solomon mess up? Yes, he did. He was a very wise man, but in some things he was not so wise. In this case, David is charging him to keep the law and do what that he'll succeed if he'll do that. Now, we're getting off topic here, but how did Solomon start his kingship? Where was this moment like a genie moment that he had with God? Do you remember? He made the offerings and God appears to him in a dream and asks him what? "I'll give you whatever you want," right? And Solomon asked for wisdom. That was the answer. He asked for wisdom. And God said, because you did not ask for the death of an enemy or riches or long life and those kind of things, then you know, you will get these as well. So anyway, a very good thing as far as he started off well, but he had some issues also. And 1 Kings chapter 8, it happened when the priest came from the holy place, a cloud filled the house of the Lord so that the priest could not stand to minister because of the cloud. The glory of the Lord filled the house of the Lord. What did David want to do that he was not allowed to do? To build a temple. In 1 Kings, we see the establishment of the temple. They move from what had God been worshipped in up until this time, up until the completion of the temple. Where were people going? What were they approaching to worship God? What's that? Tabernacle, which is a fancy way of saying a tent. They went to God in a Coleman tent, okay? So they were going out to God in a tent. Obviously, it was gold and silver and all that kind of stuff, not quite a Coleman tent. But you understand what I'm saying. It was not a permanent structure that they were going out to meet God in. And David said, "I want a house. I want to build this for you." God said, "No, you can't do it, but Solomon can." David did everything he possibly could but build. By that I mean he collected resources, collected funds, got timber, got things in place for it to be built so that when Solomon came along and Solomon wore the crown, all he had to do was push the big red button to start the process. David did everything he could but actually build the temple. And we see when the temple's completed, we see this cloud, the presence of God, the Shekinah glory as it's called, enter into the house of the Lord. This was a huge, huge moment for the Jewish people. And so here we see that fulfillment in 1 Kings. Another good and important thing for us to look at is Naaman. What's important about the story of Naaman? Naaman, so now Naaman, captain of the army of the kings of Aram, was a great man with his master and highly respected because by him the Lord had given victory to Aram. The man was also a valiant warrior, but he was a leper. Yeah. He's a great guy, but he's a leper. It's falling apart on us. Well, so 2 Kings chapter 5, what happens here? Exactly. So here's the voice of a child, out of the voice of babes, comes this message. There's a prophet in Israel that could heal him. And finally that message gets to Naaman, and he goes. What's interesting is his hesitancy to obey, right? Why did he not obey? What was his commandment? What did he need to do? Again, open book, you can turn there. What was he supposed to do? Go dip seven times, right? Go dip seven times. And why did he say no? Not just say no, but like about faced and left. What's that? It was supposed to be a big deal. He came with his whole entourage. He came with all these fairs and things to buy this gift, and it wasn't. What happened was that the prophet didn't even come out to see him. He sent his servant out. So this whole entourage arrives at this dusty little hovel of a house, my imagination, and it's quiet. And they blow the fanfare, and it's quiet. And a servant opens a creaky door, closes it behind them, walks over to Naaman and says, just go dip in the river seven times. Have a nice day. Turns around and walks back and closes the door. That is not what he wanted, right? He wanted the whole big show, right? He came prepared to buy the show. He wanted the complete package, and he didn't get it. He goes to leave, and again, the voice of a servant says, if he had asked you to do some great thing, this is a paraphrase, great big thing, if he had asked you to go kill a dragon, you would have killed the dragon, right? All he's asking you to do is dip in the river. So again, this example of obedience, which also plays nicely into New Testament teaching about baptism, just saying. Anyway, so it's a great passage in 2 Kings, rather. 2 Kings, so the Lord was very angry with Israel and removed them from his sight. None was left except the tribe of Judah. Foreshadowing again, this talking about the 10 tribes going into captivity. We see even how the sins of those kings played out. Because what did they do whenever they separated? And then Jeroboam recognized that if the people keep going down to Jerusalem to worship, what's going to happen? I'm going to be king of nothing very soon, right? And so he sets up this second system of worship, and it's a false system with false priests in false locations and doing things in false and erroneous ways. And that actually plays out, you see that play out in John chapter 4, right? When with the Samaritan woman at the well, they're still kind of practicing some of those things even in that time. And of course, so that's obviously way in the future, but because of their apostasy, they're taking into captivity. And it's Hezekiah that prays to the Lord in chapter 19. Isaiah the son of Amos sent to Hezekiah saying, thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, because you have prayed to me about Sennacherib, king of Assyria, I have heard you. And it's interesting that Sennacherib actually wrote about this event, didn't write all the details about being routed by an angel of the Lord. Didn't mention that, but did mention in his telling of this event, we see in his obelisk, that he wrote that he had King Hezekiah trapped like a bird in a cage. I mean, that's what he says. But he doesn't say that, you know, we tucked tail and ran because God came after us with an angel and killed a bunch of my guys. He doesn't mention that part. But here we see that Hezekiah prayed to the Lord, and the Lord heard him. And so they were delivered in that time. Moving hurriedly along, 1st and 2nd Chronicles is essentially a Cliff's Notes version of 1st and 2nd Samuel, 1st and 2nd Kings. And so it's kind of this condensed version. Also, some things that are different about the two things is that 1st and 2nd Chronicles first focuses mostly on sort of the priestly side of the influence in the priests, whereas 1st and 2nd Samuel and 1st and 2nd Kings, you see a lot more working with the prophets. 1st and 2nd Samuel and 1st and 2nd Kings also deal with the whole picture, the broad picture, whereas Chronicles deals more with the line of David and doesn't get into the details of all the other things. 1st and 2nd Chronicles also starts with Adam, deals with the genealogies all the way up to the history of the kings of Judah as well. So it covers a much broader time period. The first, essentially, 9 chapters are the genealogies of people. And so that's a lot of, if you like genealogies, which there's some neat things. If you go through and read genealogies, you'll get to learn the word begot a lot. But there's some neat little snippets of information that they give in there, and you see where people were related to where. Anyway, it's pretty interesting if you like that kind of stuff. So, but here we see the difference between Chronicles and 1st and 2nd Samuel and 1st and 2nd Kings. It was written by Ezra after they're coming back from captivity, so that kind of gives you a reason as to why we have these genealogies and why they're given this brief history again. Do we need to know our origins? Does it help us to know where we've come from and making steps to go forward? Yes, obviously it does. And not everybody was taught over in when they were in captivity. Not everybody necessarily would have known some of these things, especially some of the children that are coming back. And so it's important to know, here's how God has worked with us. Here's what we were, and we're going to do that again. We're going to go back and be a nation that honors God. And so they start that process with Ezra, and we'll talk about that later on. But in 1 Chronicles 21, "But King David said to Ornan, 'No, but I will surely buy it for the full price, for I will not make what is yours for take what is yours for the Lord, or offer a burnt offering which costs me nothing.'" Another snippet from the life of David. If you turn to 1 Chronicles chapter 21, what was David wanting to do? He wanted to make a sacrifice, but what was he?
He wanted to purchase the threshing floor.
Yes. He's wanting to purchase this threshing floor. I gotta be careful, that can be a tongue twister early in the morning. So he wanted to purchase this location to make a sacrifice to God, and it would later on become a very important location. But what does David teach us here? What does David teach us here?
The definition of sacrifice. You have to give something up personally.
Yes. If I was going to offer something to God that cost me nothing, is that a sacrifice? By no means. And Ornan is offering this to the king. Whose sacrifice would it have been had Ornan done this? It would have been Ornan's sacrifice, right? And David said, "I want to sacrifice. I want to do this." This is a very important passage looking at the very definition of what it is to sacrifice. And God being a man, David rather, being a man after God's own heart, sees that and actually makes this offering to God on this occasion. And the next passage, 2 Chronicles chapter 6. "Now it was in the heart of my father David to build a house for the name of the Lord, the God of Israel. But the Lord said to my father David, 'Because it was in your heart to build a house for my name, you did well that it was in your heart.'" So God is saying it's good that you had this in your heart, but Solomon's recognizing here in this context that he couldn't, but they continued to do and to build the temple. The next chapter 7, "And my people who are called by my name humble themselves and pray, seek my face, and turn from their wicked ways, then I will hear from heaven and will forgive their sin and will heal their land." Why is it important for these people who are coming back from captivity to hear this? coming back from captivity to hear these kind of things that had been said earlier.
So they don't go back into captivity.
So we don't go back. They need to repent. Exactly. And we'll see that when we get into talking about Ezra and Nehemiah in just a moment. We'll see why it's important that they understand this construct. They must return back to God. It hurts them as a people when they're not returning with their whole heart to God. Not only as a people, but their land as well. So when we look in the book of Ezra, this begins a time of restoration. This is after the captivity. So we're covering a period from about 1100 B.C. to about mid-500 B.C. as far as time frame in our class today. So we're really having time on fast forward this morning. So this begins a time of restoration and building of temple. And we have the restoration under Zerubbabel and reforms with Ezra. So they go back to build the temple. And so this is an important book. We start to see starting things over again. And this passage in Ezra chapter 1, verses 1 and 2. Now in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, in order to fulfill the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah, the Lord stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, so that he sent a proclamation throughout all his kingdom, and also put in writing, saying, "Thus says Cyrus, king of Persia, the Lord, the God of heaven, has given me all the kings of the earth, and he has appointed me to build him a house in Jerusalem, which is in Judah." Why is this important? Why is this? What's that? Yes. So, and we see that from time to time, right? We saw that even with Naaman. Naaman was used by God to defeat certain people. And we see those kind of, you know, like risk kind of pieces move around. God uses other kingdoms to do different things. And here's one of those things. God used Cyrus, king of Persia, to fulfill a promise. But what's interesting is this was something that had been spoken of by whom? Isaiah and Jeremiah, and all these things that were supposed to be taking place were mentioned. And so even in this case, so this took place. And so this is important, not only just people returning back as was promised, but returning back at the time that was promised. Also in chapter 3, "Yet many of the priests and Levites and heads of fathers' households, the old men who had seen the first temple, wept with a loud voice when the foundation of the house was laid before their eyes. While many shouted for joy, so the people could not distinguish the sound of shout for joy from the sound of weeping of the people. For the people shouted with a loud shout, and the sound was heard far away." What's happening? What is happening? What are we building? In this case, we're rebuilding the temple, right? We're laying that foundation. But why these two reactions? Why these two reactions? Remember, we're coming back from captivity. Some of them may have been children when they were taken into captivity and had seen Solomon's temple.
Seen the beauty of it, and they're seeing what they're building now. There's no comparison.
Maybe there's no comparison. And weeping that we're finally back, right? That we're finally getting to rebuild. And so there's shouts of joy, there's weeping, there's all kinds of emotion going on with going back to God and being able to establish again and be able to worship out from underneath the thumb of another government, essentially, and worship God and build this house. And so it specifically mentions that old men who had seen the first temple wept with a loud voice when they had just laid the foundation. So they're just getting started here when they're laying the foundation. But it's important to see that people are going back to God. In chapter 10, this goes into the reforms. "Then Ezra the priest stood up and said to them, 'You have been unfaithful and have married foreign wives, adding to the guilt of Israel. Now therefore make confession to the Lord God of your fathers and do his will, and separate yourselves from the peoples and the land from the foreign wives.' Then all the assembly replied with a loud voice, 'That is right, as you have said, so it is our duty to do.'" There needed to be some reform. What had they done that they should not have done? They needed to confess their sins. They had intermarried with people they were not supposed to, right? And the command was, you were unfaithful in who you married. You need to separate. But it's love. Love conquers all, right? What did God say about his commandment? This is who you can and cannot marry. He was very, very explicit on that.
And he said, these lives will lead you away from me.
Yes. And not only did he say, don't do this, this is why you don't need to do it. And it actually happened, right? That happened before. And so here we are starting again. This is a do-over. And we're trying to go back to God. And where have we messed up? In bringing in an outside influence that could take us away, that had in the past taken us away from God. And Ezra's like, nope. We got to turn this off now. Turn this off now. And remove those wives. Now, it is not saying that they weren't supposed to provide for them and their children, but they were no longer to be married. And so they. And what was the response of the men? We need to do this, right? We need to do this. And I actually saw this play out, not exactly like this. I wasn't there, but in when I was in Nigeria, it's not uncommon in other countries for people to have multiple wives. They'll have a wife in the city, and they'll have a wife and a family in the bush. And there was a couple that came from several hours away to meet with one of the preachers and talk with them. What is it that we need to do in order to make our lives right with God? And he says, you need to stay with the wife that you married first and put the other away. And they did that. And of course, it's not an easy thing, but they did that. Yes, sir. So where are you going with this? You realize that we have like 5 minutes. No, okay. But there could there be a case, and this will be something you study, could there be a case that I might be in a marriage that I shouldn't be in? There could be. And I have studied people who are in marriages that they should not be in. And to obey is better than sacrifice. And we need to make sure we're doing what's right. But we don't have time to dive into that. I can point you to some YouTube videos on that if you'd like. So Nehemiah, what does Nehemiah build? Or what does he build with the help of the Lord? The wall, right? So you have a city, you're rebuilding it, and you need a defensive wall because people around you are crazy. And you need to be able to protect yourselves. And so you see the first chapter, 7 chapters, we are rebuilding this wall, and then again some more reforms, but with Ezra and Nehemiah, we're contemporary people here in this time frame, and some important passages with Nehemiah. What is it that Nehemiah does throughout the story of, or so, throughout the life of Nehemiah? What do we see him doing when something happens? Nehemiah does what? Exactly. And Nehemiah was a man of prayer. You see that in the first, you see even one of his prayers, chapter 2. You see how things play out for Nehemiah. And every time there's opposition, he prays. Every time something happens, he prays. He talks to God. Even in the moment when the king asks, why is your face so long? What's going on? What do you need from me? After he talks to him about it, he says, what do you need from me? And he says, in that moment, he prayed, and then he answered the king. And so he's even using small moments like that to pray and make sure he's doing what needs to be done. But we see a man also that has a heart for the work of the Lord and for the kingdom of God, or for God's kingdom in that time. Chapter 2, again, we have this story about why is your face sad? He said, this is what's going on. He says, then I was very much afraid, because you're not supposed to be sad in front of the king. But he uses that time to say, here's what's happening. And when the king asks, what do you need? Did he hem and haw around and say, well, I'm not sure, I'll have to check on that? No, he had a plan. He said, I need these letters written so I can cut your trees down. I need this permission. I need an armed guard. So when he prayed, it wasn't like he prayed, I hope God does something. He prayed and then had things in place to fulfill what he knew God would do and use him to do that. That's the kind of prayer. That is active prayer. There's a passive prayer that says, oh, I hope God does something. And there's an active prayer that prays and then works towards that end. Do you see the difference? And Nehemiah was one that teaches us how to do active prayer and working towards that end. And that took place as we get our warning here. So they built the wall. In chapter 4, verse 6, why were they able to build the wall? Of course, God was helping them. And they had all the people who were working on this wall, working in family units. But why were they able to complete it at such a fast rate? Because why? The people had a mind to work. And that's true. That's true for no matter what. If you go into, you move to a place and go into a congregation and nobody wants to do anything, then nothing's going to happen. But the people have to have a mind to work for things to move and God to use it. Again, that's an active concept. And again, he tells them not to be afraid. When I saw the fear, because there was opposition, Sanballat and Tobiah were, you know, being mean about what was happening. They did not want good things to happen for these people. And he says, don't be afraid of them. Fight for your brothers, your sons, your daughters, your wives, your houses. Put everything on the line. Fight for everything. All right? This is a battle cry, right? I mean, he needed a painted blue face and a long sword. This is what that kind of moment for Nehemiah as they were building the wall. And again, they completed it. So the wall was completed in 25th of the month, and 52 days it was built. And when the enemies heard it, they said what? What do they think? Who built the wall? Who built the wall? The people built it, but even the enemies acknowledged what? That God. That God was involved in this process, in building a wall so quickly. So let's move hurriedly to Esther. What's interesting about this book is God's name is not even mentioned in this book, but it shows God's continued promise or protection of his people even in captivity. We see the danger for the Jews in the first three chapters that they were going to be killed and all that took place there, and then the deliverance and how that took place. An important passage with Esther. Again, a point that gets overlooked quite a bit. Queen Vashti, who was queen before Esther, refused to come out to the king's command because they were wanting to, you know, gaze upon her, right? She said no and stood up for what was right and stood up for... So that's something that kind of gets overlooked. Why she decided to say no, we don't know. We can't judge her motive, but she said, no, I'm not going to do that. And she was punished for it, but anyway, I think that's important to note. We don't have time to go into that, but looking more at this passage, chapter 4, and encouraging Esther here, it's for if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, and you and your father's house will perish, and who knows whether or not you have attained royalty for such a time as this. Again, a very important passage in the book of Esther. And, you know, we are certain that God is going to deliver his people. But are you going to be the instrument by which that happens? Or are you going to let that pass to somebody else? But we're certain that God is going to deliver his people from this moment. And he did. And then we get to have that phrase, hang him higher than Haman, afterwards. So it makes for a good Western phrase. Anybody watch Westerns? Anybody? Okay. Sorry. Moving along. So here we have the book of Esther. And again, the completion of this section of history, and we covered quite a bit of material here, but again, just trying to get snippets enough so we can go through the idea that we can, at the end of this class, without any kind of fear and trepidation, go through and talk about, here's what God did in the Old Testament. Here's how it unfolds. Here's the high points through the Old Testament, and so that you can go into talking about the New Testament and why that is very important. Any questions or comments before we close? All right. Thank you very much for your time this morning. Appreciate it.